This is an ABC podcast.
Breasts. Once more we take Occam's razor to that delicate subject. And I must declare right at the start what breasts mean to me as a male biologist. Well, first, breasts are modified sebaceous glands. Instead of secreting oils to emulsify skin and small hairs, the glands made milk for the offspring of little mammals several million years ago, and so breasts came to be. Second, there is the intelligent bra, as developed by the University of Wollongong and New South Wales Scientist of the Year, Dr. Gordon Wallace, et al. The bra is worn by athletic women and adjusts to the jostling from rapid movement to give comfort and support. But what do breasts mean to Chloe Warren? She has a PhD in medical genetics and is based in Newcastle, New South Wales. She, as a communicator and scientist, has a sceptical mien, especially about breasts.
My friend Alex is a hugely talented writer and poet. We met just after I finished my PhD, and it's been really fun spending time with a bookish nerd as opposed to a nerdy nerd. Last November, she was raising money for One Girl. Look it up, it's a fantastic cause, through her campaign No Makeup November. She asked me to submit a makeup-free selfie and reassured me that if that wasn't my jam, she'd also accept a photo of me sans bra. Telling me this jogs her memory, and she starts to tell me about a French study she read which proved that bras actually makes your boobs sag faster. Wait, what? How's that even possible? I said. Something to do with the wearing down of the tissue. She's also from South Carolina. No, I mean, how would you even conduct an experiment to prove that? I don't know, you're the scientist, she replied. Truth be told, I'm actually technically a science communicator, and I've always got my eyes peeled for what we in the industry call a sexy story. When it comes to sexiness in science, we tend to factor in grossness, cuteness, and bigness. Think pus, think kittens, think particle accelerators. It's rare to get something as legitimately sexy as breasts handed to you on a platter. In short, I realised I'd stumbled across the perfect blog topic, and after I got home that evening, I took it upon myself to find this mysterious French boob study. I knuckled down and prepared to debunk this obscure-sounding hypothesis. In less scientific terms, I suppose you could say I was gonna rip it a new one. If you were setting out to investigate whether wearing a bra helped or hindered breast perkiness, the first thing you'd need to find would be some breasts. And lots of them. You might think you could try and find two groups of women, those who had worn bras their whole lives and those that hadn't. Indeed, the first question I asked my friend Alex was, how did I even find enough women who don't wear bras? To which she replied, duh, it was France. But the trouble with this approach to your boob study is that you only have one time point. You could measure boob sagginess, but how would you know whether the women's breasts had drooped over time or whether they just started out lower? I kept this point in the back of my head for when I found the paper in question. So we know we need at least two time points. So we know we are measuring boob drooping as opposed to boob position. Another concern with this approach is that whatever choice women make regarding their undergarments, it is just that, a choice. And choices are undoubtedly determined by other factors. In this case, some of the major factors, boob size, level of activity or preferred kind of exercise, boob sensitivity, boob bounceability, these things may also influence boob droopage too. Not so great in controlling for variables. Ideally, we'd need to find a big group of women and randomly assign them to two groups, bra wearer and non-bra wearer. I suppose we could also find two naturally occurring groups of bra wearers and non-bra wearers and ensure that both have a diverse representation of boob size, sensitivity, bounceability, and preferred type of exercise. But these things might prove difficult to measure and may rely on personal reporting, which are things we do try to avoid as they can mess with the reliability of the data. Again, I keep these points in the back of my head for when I find the scientific report. Even once we've got our two groups of ladies together, however we go about it, we need to sit back and wait for the sagging to occur. If it is going to occur, that is. And this is going to require a lot of waiting. Several years of waiting. And when I get my hands on this sodding paper, you can be sure I'll be scrutinising just how long they spent waiting. And the longer they spent waiting, the bigger I'll want their test groups to be. Because as any behavioural scientist will tell you, the longer the study, the more dropouts. And we need for our test groups to be nice and big so we can ensure that any differences that we spot are statistically significant. Oh boy, look at all the ammunition I'm going to have to scrutinise this study with. And if we're going to get really fussy, It's not just a matter of recruiting a bunch of women, giving them instructions, and then calling them back into the lab in 10 years' time. You're going to need to look after them, keep them accountable for a start, but also make sure they're wearing a bra that fits them well. And get ready for your cohort numbers to drop, because everyone loves a good bra fitting, am I right? Or as I like to call them, body scrutinising sessions. Stepping up on the fussiness levels, it would be ideal if your bra-wearing cohort could wear the same style bra. Hands up who wants to wear a prescribed bra for the next 10 years and attend regular bra fittings. Yeah, you're going to need to pay these poor people. Once I had thought of all the ways I could possibly scrutinise this paper, I actually put myself to the task of finding it. Usually when I'm looking for a specific paper, I might know the journal or the author of the date, so I'll go to a scientific publication database and try and narrow it down by these terms. However, the only keywords I had at this point were French and bra, and I knew that these were unlikely to qualify as relevant keywords in scientific publication databases. And so I started my search, like most people, with Google. The first result was from 2013. Bras make breasts sag, 15-year study concludes. That was in Medical News Today, within which I found the quote. Rullion, the scientist, found that women who never wore bras had nipples on average 7 millimetres higher in relation to their shoulders each year than regular bra users. All his volunteers were between 18 and 35 years old. The article doesn't include a link to the original study, but it references an interview with Reuters, and down the rabbit hole we go. In the Reuters article, there's a reference to a French radio interview. It's linked, but I don't speak French, and there's no transcription. Back to Google page one. HuffPost. Do women need bras? French study said brassieres are a false necessity. Again, no links to original study. CBS. French study suggests younger women should stop wearing bras. Again, no link to original study. Telegraph, News.com, Women's Health, The Mirror, Guardian. No links to the original study. I at least know the name of the researcher now, though, so I move over to a scientific database and type in his name. There are 25 results. None of them include the word bra or breast. I go through each one. I move to Google Scholar, just in case the database I've been using is lacking. This time I find 45 papers. I do find one article entitled Haut les Seins? I don't speak French. I get hopeful because the literal translation in English is boobs up, but it's just a sociological study on bra symbolism. After exhausting my resources, I come to a strange conclusion. This famous French bra study never existed. From the sounds of one interview on student radio, I might add, which spawned all this attention, the scientist did begin a trial. He may have even measured some women's nipples, but the results of the study were never published. For a study to be published, a bunch of other scientists working in the same field have to check that the paper meets quality standards. Maybe the study didn't get past this peer review process. Maybe they didn't even get that far. Maybe they didn't get enough evidence to warrant writing a paper. I personally learned a whole lot from this scenario, though not as much as I would have liked to about boobs. As a science communicator, I spend a lot of my time reassuring scientists that I won't publish anything inaccurate. This is because of incidences like these, where the media can take one whiff of a titillating story and run around like headless chickens on fire in a city built entirely of straw. It would be great if media outlets could hire people who know how to research a scientific paper to actually be able to report on these scientific papers. Then again, there's no money in journalism, so I might as well request a diamond-encrusted MacBook for anyone who spots a typo in an online article. Scientists also need to learn how to deal with media. You can't march into a recording studio and say, "Our first results confirm the hypothesis that the bra is a false need. Medically, physiologically, anatomically, the breast does not benefit from being deprived of gravity. Instead, it languishes without a bra." And that's a quote from the original radio interview. You can't say that and expect a reporter to realise that the two most significant words in that phrase are not bra and breast, but first results. This balance between a scientist's needs for their work to be accurately explained and a journalist's needs for their articles to be read and increasingly commented on is a tricky one. It's where science communicators like me come in really handy. And if you hadn't all realised, the whole point of this monologue is to demonstrate just how great we are. That's right, I will blow my own trumpet. Because I just spent the last 10 minutes talking about the limitations of scientific methodologies, and you are still listening.
We hope. Dr. Chloe Warren with her scientific version of Media Watch. She is based in Newcastle, New South Wales. And while musing about clothing and support, what about trousers? Do shops and tailors still ask men on which side they dress? And what does this mean? And if they get it wrong, are there testicular consequences? Lowered sperm counts? Must ask Chloe. Next week, still in Newcastle, how we react to disasters, but not of the trousered kind. I'm Robin Williams.